This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Well, it's been a long election campaign. Some would say it's been a bit tedious. And there's not been that much on health. And what we decided for this last health report before the election on Saturday is that we would try to cover some of the health issues that have not been covered by the campaign, by the major parties. So we've got a panel who know what they're talking about with us today. Dr. Chris Moy, who's Vice President of the AMA and a general practitioner in South Australia. Professor Stephen Duckett of the University of Melbourne and former Health Program Director at the Grattan Institute. Dr. Rachel David, who's CEO of Private Healthcare Australia. That's the umbrella organisation for private health insurance. And last but not least, Pat Turner, who's CEO of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, NACHO, which is the umbrella organisation for Aboriginal medical services, which are community controlled. Welcome to all four of you.
Hi, Norman.
Pat, you've just had a study done of the economics of healthcare in Aboriginal communities.
That's right. We commissioned Equity Economics to look at the gap in health expenditure in terms of what is paid by the government for all Australians and for Aboriginal people. And we have found that for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we require an additional $5,042 per head of population in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. And that equates to $4.4 billion shortfall in funding Aboriginal health in this country. So 2.6 billion of that is from the Commonwealth, and 1.8 is from the states and the territories in terms of what they should be inputting.
So this is the gap between, and this is adjusted for the health status of Aboriginal people.
Absolutely. So we have just over two times the burden of disease that other Australians have on average, and the life expectancy of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander still remains 8 to 9 years below that of other Australians. And we have rates like rheumatic heart disease among our youth, 55 times more likely to die from rheumatic heart disease, 3.7 times more likely to have kidney disease, 3.3 times more likely to have diabetes, 3.2 times more likely to suicide as youth, and 2.1 times more likely to die in infancy. So these are pretty horrific statistics. And what's driving this is the overall lack of funding or equal funding to make up for the health gap because we can't close the gap between the life outcomes of our people until we get at least equal funding, as other Australians do, on the basis of need.
So when these statistics have been put out before, it's been in terms of Medicare and the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, and which is a pretty crude measure of what I presume Aboriginal people need. In other words, if you're living in Toorak or Vaucluse or Nedlands, you are disproportionately overusing Medicare for your health status, and Aboriginal people are proportionately underutilizing, as in fact are elderly people in Australia. So is it just more doctor visits here, or is the money to be spent more sophisticatedly?
Well, we like to spend whatever money we get in a more sophisticated and strategic manner. And so in each of our pre-budget treasury submissions, we've outlined these. And of course, we've done an election submission to both the major parties and drew their attention to this $4.4 billion funding shortfall for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people throughout Australia. So many of our people are hospitalised. And if you just even look at hospitalisation figures from AIHW, I think they were done a few years ago. They're a bit old. The three main reasons for hospitalisation can be prevented if they get the proper primary health care in the first place. So, and the hospital discharge or what do you call it, leave without, you know, doctor's consent.
Signing yourself out, yeah.
Yeah, signing yourself out. You know, some 20,000 Aboriginal people do that a year. And we're really worried about this because of the treatment of Aboriginal people in hospitals and the fact that they have to travel so far away from home.
So to what extent has this been addressed by either party, in the major party in the campaign?
No, not really. But both, we've had some increases from Greg Hunt for the infrastructure funding, but our sector's nearly, you know, 50 years old. Our first health service was set up in Redfern. But our infrastructure needs are so great, almost $1 billion, which we've been telling the government about for several years. So we have got an increase of $260 odd million over the next few years, which is a huge injection, and we're very pleased with that. But it's still a shortfall of, you know, $750 million, if you like. There's been a commitment towards GPs by Anthony Albanese of $1 billion, and so we expect our fair share of that. In fact, we expect at least 6% of that $1 billion to go to ARCHOs because of the health needs of our people. And then there's been bits and pieces of announcements, but it's not really in an overall strategic manner, which is the way that we like to do things.
I might come to Chris Moy. I mean, Chris, this is a discussion about primary care. Sorry to get technical for the audience, but it is the cornerstone of our system, the general practitioner, and also all the other healthcare professionals that work in the community. What's missing from your point of view?
Well,
and that conversation with Pat was almost entirely about primary care.
The interesting thing is that her group is on the same group as us, which is the Primary Care Task Force, which was set up by the Liberal government, which spent 2 years trying to develop a thing called a 10-year primary health plan.
And wasn't funded in the budget.
Yes, which was left on the table. And in fact, already had previously had $450 million budgeted, but somehow disappeared into general revenue. And the interesting thing is that last week, after 4 weeks of fluff and bluster about policy, health policy, we saw actually the first major significant announcement that something may actually make the difference in one area, which is primary care, general practice, which was the announcement by the Albanese government of a pledge for $1 billion to really change the way we fund general practice to some degree, evolve general practice.
So just talk us through that $1 billion, because Pat mentioned it there, because the whole principle, and we've covered the 10-year reform plan on the health report, is based on changing the model, because Medicare doesn't work very well in general practice.
Look, we've had this banal debate about bulk billing rates for so long, and all this is about a $38 rebate to help patients see their doctor. And unfortunately, because of these freezes that have occurred over a long period of time, that $38 has become so behind what it should be. What has happened now is that the way medicine is provided in general practice, or favoured in health economic terms, is a conveyor belt, short transaction, 6-minute type medicine, which is useful for simple problems, but not for the world that we live in now, which is actually where we have a lot of people with aged chronic diseases.
So is the ALP, Pat and I used the word sophisticated there, is the ALP planning to spend that $1 billion in a sophisticated way and not just pour money, good money after bad, in terms of the fact that the existing system doesn't work?
Well, this is where it's funding the Liberal Party's own plan, ironically, which has been agreed by every stakeholder, AMA, RACGP, all the major stakeholders, including consumer groups, the Consumer Health Forum. But essentially what the idea is to base funding in the future and favour funding on a thing called voluntary patient enrolment, so that instead of actually favouring volume, which is the way it is at the moment, and a transaction as far as the basis of medicine, what it'll be is that people will vote with their feet and sign up on a voluntary basis to a practice that they believe will provide high quality care, does provide high quality care. But as part of that, funding starts to go to those practices that are willing to provide the more time with their patient, more services like allied health and nurses, more after hours, more home visits, those sort of things, which is what people want and need, especially in a world where we have far more chronic disease and aged people who are stuck at home, and not to favour just this transactional conveyor belt type medicine, but to shift it in the way that people need.
So two questions. One is, what's in the 10-year plan for Aboriginal communities? Mm-hmm. I asked Pat this before we came on air, sure. And she said it doesn't look as if it's a lot. And secondly, the AMA has been the bastion of fee-for-service, and the 10-year plan moves away from fee-for-service.
Okay. First up is, as we have moved on, and
the AMA
has moved on, that we do need to understand that fee-for-service will still be important as being the basis of medicine, you know, for a lot of the simple problems, but we need to change funding to favour the sort of high quality care. People are not so much worried about they want more time with their doctor. They actually want more that longitudinal relationship, that birth to death relationship, which is what this favours. But in terms of other areas like rural and Indigenous populations, they are very much a part of that, because we need to change the way that the care is provided there, because we realise that, for example, fee-for-service in particular doesn't work because the doctors are not there to provide the care.
We'll come back to consulting communities and allowing community control in a minute. Rachel David from the private health insurance industry, what happens in general practice matters a lot to you, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. The downgrading of primary care and general practice in particular relative to other parts of the health system has had quite a serious impact, particularly with older people that are seeking care for chronic conditions, and they're not being worked up in the appropriate way in, you know, the bulk billing clinics and with the 6-minute consultations. They're often pushed down an interventionist path far too early, and often, and in many cases, end up seeing the wrong practitioner for the wrong reasons, and end up with sub-quality care that pushes them back into the system at a later point. Now, this is something that can be prevented, but we need to understand that the Medicare system, as it was set up, including the bolt-on part that is private health insurance, which is connected to the Medicare system through the MBS.
So just to explain, when you make a claim on your private health insurance, the private health insurance company uses the Medicare rebate. First of all, is there a Medicare rebate? And secondly, that's the basis for which they reimburse you as a member of a private health insurance company.
That's correct. So we're not separate. It's connected together. When people seek care in a private hospital or in some cases in the community. But this was a system that was designed in the late 70s and 1980s. And we don't even have the same diseases now. I think Dr. Chris Moy alluded to the fact that, you know, we're now managing a number of frail-aged people, but also a number of people who are in early to late middle age who are working much longer. And they're seeking care much like they'd tune up their car. You know, they're going to have their hip replacement or their knee replacement because they want to go back to work or keep looking after their grandchildren or travel the world. And they've got 30 years of doing this. They need to get on the right track and have someone manage their life journey through that process.
So would you, I mean, there has been a movement from the private health insurance industry, controversial, to cover people outside hospital, because you're not allowed to cover people outside hospital at the moment.
No, we're not. And I think this is an increasing source of frustration for private health insurance members. Private health insurance, the way it was designed back under the Hawke-Keating and the Hawke-Keating era, it does an excellent job at covering people for in-hospital care, including some very, very complex and expensive cases. But for out-of-hospital care, people can be left with some extraordinary out-of-pockets for their specialist care. And, you know, even people that need regular GP consults, not only is the GP poorly remunerated by Medicare, but, you know, if they charge out-of-pockets as well, that can really put people off. So I think that what private health insurance can do, if we think about this in a pragmatic way, there is a group of people, 14 million people in the community, that are prepared to pay something towards the cost of their care. They would ideally like to have a family doctor that can see them through cradle to grave, as Dr. Moy mentioned. And it is crazy to think that in some way the funding that is generated through private health insurance can't in some way help that process. I don't think.
But of course, GPs would argue it creates a two-tier system. You know, two classes of patients or complexity. You might be with HCF,
but it only does that if you try and throw money at it through the existing non-fit-for-purpose MBS system, and if you're always chasing these MBS rebates. I think we need to look at this through a more sophisticated lens, as we've talked about it before. Are there specific areas in which private health insurance can make a contribution to a practice for things like pain management in the community, like multidisciplinary pain management in the community or managing addictions in the community, which are two things which drive a lot of people into hospital care? And some of it is actually very ineffective hospital care because they've gone down the intervention path too early or they've been sent to a super specialist in the wrong area.
You're listening to the Health Report here on Radio National with me, Norman Swan, and I'm talking at the moment to Rachel David from Private Healthcare Australia. Also with us is Dr. Chris Moy, Vice President of the AMA, Pat Turner, National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, NACHO. And sorry, I'll come back to you. Well, actually, one more question. I've also got Stephen Duckett on the line. I'm just going to bring him on in a second from the University of Melbourne. Just one final question is, we seem to have some private health insurers, amazingly, who are supporting the Labor Party in this campaign.
Look, private health insurance isn't a political product. I mean, predominantly the people that purchase private health insurance are women, and they're working women with children, also supporting older relatives. So whatever that demographic chooses to do might be influencing how this is being perceived. So we're here to represent our members, which are health funds, and their members, which are people choosing to take out private health insurance. And professional women are by far the biggest growing group, but they're also the group that's currently disrupting federal politics. So make of that what you will.
Stephen Duckett, what's missing from the campaign?
So as Chris said, right up until the end, we haven't had much in terms of primary care. And unless you get primary care right, it is the foundation level of the system, the whole system falls apart. The other thing that's missing from the campaign is the reality of COVID. COVID is still with us. People are still dying from COVID. There are three times as many deaths from COVID this calendar year than in the previous two calendar years. So it is amazing that we haven't had a lot of discussion about it. Health workers around the country are just overwhelmed at the moment under an enormous pressure. The emergency departments are overwhelmed, partly because the emergency departments were overwhelmed before COVID, but partly because people are getting sick. People have deferred their care during the pandemic, during the peak of the pandemic. They're now coming up for care. The beds are now being used to catch up on elective procedures which were deferred, and yet neither party has mentioned the word COVID. Neither party has proposed any solutions to help deal with the backlog and the overhang. Why do I think it is? Well, I think it's partly because the coalition doesn't want to mention the word COVID because it managed the pandemic so incredibly badly, and Labor doesn't want to mention the COVID because it will be immediately suggested that they want to lock people up and throw away the key and reintroduce lockdown. So, you know, both are embarrassed about it.
Stephen Duckett, why there still seems to be a disconnect in both political parties from understanding what determines your health. And what determines your health is to some extent, well, to a large extent, your education, what sort of housing you have, what job do you have. There doesn't seem to be an explicit link amongst the major parties. Is that fair?
Well, the Labor Party has put forward a proposal for a Centre for Disease Control, which I think is a bad name, but in their proposal, they have said this is something that's going to deal, amongst other things, with social and economic determinants of health, our housing and economic issues and the social and cultural issues that impact on your health. Unfortunately, everybody has said, oh, this is all about infectious diseases. Well, no, it's not. If it's about prevention, if it's about disease control, we have to think about that broadly, and we have to think about it in terms of someone has to deal with the social and economic determinants of health. We just have to look at COVID, and the death rate in poor neighbourhoods was 2.5 times in wealthy neighbourhoods. So, you know, we saw the impact of socioeconomic determinants during COVID, and we see it all the time in the other parts of the system.
Chris Moy, let's just move on to another topic, which is getting some coverage, but again, doesn't seem to have an impact on the campaign, which is what Stephen Duckett referred to there, which is ramping and hospital stress. And you've got this disconnect between GPs who are paid for by the Commonwealth and hospitals that are paid for by the states. And there's no incentive really for GPs to make a difference here.
Yes, unfortunately, part of the problem in our health system is all we live in silos, we work in silos, and we don't owe each other anything to some degree, and that's actually been part of the problem. But having said that, I think we really do need to shore up general practice. But in amongst all the things like the 10-year plan, there is the possibility of us starting to link results in general practice in terms of improving patients' quality of care for, say, diabetes, which may, if you handle it poorly.
But wouldn't it be better with one system? Just give it all to the states and let the states coordinate, you know, pay. That's what Rachel's talking about, isn't it, really? Private health insurance have got skin in the game. If they pay general practice for results, it means that, in theory, patients get a better outcome and the hospitals have lower utilization and your premiums go down or stay the same.
You're fundamentally talking about a problem about federation, which has actually blocked a lot of this over time. I mean, Kevin Rudd tried this a while ago, and that actually blocked a lot of the things. And the problem is, it is an issue of people not having skin in the game of the results of a patient when it's easier to transfer a patient to the next port of call. But I think the thing is that what you can do is actually try to make sure that the funding is such, for example, in general practice, the way head down the line of 10-year primary care, but also make sure that up the other end, we start actually talking with each other. So that, for example, I'll give you an example. A lot of the funding in hospital funding, for example, does it favour, for example, even you've talked about private, for them working with general practitioners to try and work together as a team to try and stop that patient who's got a complex illness ending up in hospital later. And there is great opportunity for that, which is a discussion where we start to need to be a little bit more innovative and actually see how we can actually make the funding actually fit the model that we want to be.
But the system's broke. Pat, I might come back to you, but it is about what determines health, and nowhere is that more acute than in Aboriginal communities. And I was challenging Stephen Duckett that nobody seems to be talking or understanding at a party level whether or not, you know, the fact that something like housing has an enormous impact on this. What are you observing in terms of the campaigns and the promises by government?
Well, I think it's been pretty weak. I mean, I think that the Labor Party has said something about social housing, but, you know, for home ownership, and the coalition or the Liberal Party's policy allowing people to access super, well, it'd be nice to have a job so our people could get super for a start. It's also a fact that we don't have a lot of private health insurance holders because of the poverty in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia. But the social determinants of health have been a key part of the agenda of Aboriginal community controlled health from the beginning, because we know how much housing and overcrowded housing and unhealthy housing impacts on the residents of those places. So Housing has always been a key issue. We have a policy on housing for health, and we advocate that at every opportunity with government to fix these underlying causes. I don't think you can separate housing and environmental health. I think they go hand in hand together. Like our model of care is a comprehensive primary care model, and primary care being people having access to the medical care when they want it and need it as close as possible to where they live. And we have a multifaceted system where we're able to provide allied health services as well as, and our Aboriginal health workers, of course, play a key role in our service delivery. But housing is absolutely fundamental, and the pandemic has shown that up in every Australian's lounge rooms. And, you know, Blind Freddie could see how much needs to be done to fix Aboriginal housing in this country. And that's the fault of the Commonwealth and the states and territories.
Now, one of the cornerstone of the Australian healthcare system is universal healthcare, that to each according to their need, which is what Pat Turner's referred to right at the beginning, and you don't get shortchanged because you can't afford it. How much is that under threat at the moment, Rachel David? Because out-of-pocket costs are thought to be one of the causes of the threat to universal healthcare.
Yeah, look, I think some of the tenets of a universal healthcare system are access and affordability. And Pat has raised a really clear issue with access, and that is in some of these remote and rural and remote communities where a number of Aboriginal people live, it's a serious challenge to get people, qualified people to locate there and to, you know, and to build up the workforce. But on the issue of affordability, particularly for outpatient care, I think within hospital care, you know, you've got wait. You can either it's related to your ability to pay or your ability to wait. But the actual level of access is reasonably good. But for outpatient care, for particularly for people that need repeated appointments, what you've seen is a lot of state-run public hospitals actually privatise their outpatients, and a number of those doctors do charge gaps, those specialist doctors, and they don't offer free outpatients anymore. And some of those gaps are, you know, becoming pretty significant. And we've seen, you know, it can range between about $50 to $500. And in addition to that, you've got the diagnostic tests that come on top of that. And for some of the quotes that we've seen around the place for diagnostic imaging, for instance, as an outpatient, are pretty significant.
Stephen Ducker, we haven't got much time left, but to what extent is universal healthcare threatened in Australia, do you believe?
The out-of-pockets that Rachel and Pat have been talking about are a serious problem, especially for specialists. And as Rachel said, the state government, which used to provide public hospital outpatient services, has often cut those. And so people are either having to find big sums of money to see a private specialist or waiting months or years for public hospital outpatients. And it's something that government, whoever is elected on Saturday, needs to address.
Well, we've certainly scratched the surface. Thanks to our panellists, Chris Moy, South Australian General Practitioner and Vice President of the Australian Medical Association, Stephen Duckett, formerly of the Grattan Institute, now of the University of Melbourne, Rachel David of the Private Healthcare Australia, of the private health insurance industry, and last but not least, Pat Turner, who is CEO of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. This has been The Health Report. I'm Norman Swan. See you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.